WICC.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome back, folks. Tom Snyder with you, friends, here on the Thursday night radio show out of Los Angeles, California, the 25th of June, 1992. And tonight we give it a go here with a story involving two principal players in the recent nomination and confirmation of Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court of the United States. Joining us tonight is Tim Phelps. He's the co-author of Capital Games. This is the first full-length book out on the hearings involving the confirmation of Clarence Thomas and the confrontation that took place during those hearings by the law professor from the University of Oklahoma, Dr. Anita Hill. For weeks, millions of people, a lot of us, watched the confirmation hearings to find out whether or not the allegations of sexual harassment were true and how the hearing would affect Clarence Thomas's nomination to the Supreme Court. As you recall, this battle sent men against women, blacks against white, left against right, Republicans against Democrats, reaching deep into our political system. Capital Gains, the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas confrontation on the Thursday night radio show. We are back and joined by Timothy Phelps, who is the Supreme Court reporter for New York Newsday. Timothy began his career at the Providence Journal in Rhode Island, then moved on to the St. Petersburg Times. He's also been a contributor to the Baltimore Sun and the New York Times. As a matter of fact, his coverage of the Clarence Thomas Anita Hill story earned him a Pulitzer Prize nomination, and he is the co-author of a new book out, which is called, as I say, Capital Games. Timothy, thanks for coming in and welcome to our show, young man.
Thanks, Tom.
You were one of those who knew quite early on that there were charges of sexual harassment underlying the nomination of Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court. You knew that well in advance of the public.
That's right.
And where did you get that information?
Well, I got it in the process of calling everybody I could find who knew anything about Clarence Thomas, basic shoe leather reporting.
Right. And when you started making those phone calls, how far along was the Clarence Thomas nomination? Had it just been announced by
It had just been announced.
By
yeah.
President Bush. All right. So this was before the hearings of the Judiciary Committee even began, the regular confirmation hearings that later evolved into the confrontation
right.
between
right.
these two. Who do you start to call when you're looking to find out about a Supreme Court nominee?
Well, what I did was pretty basic. I got a hold of an old telephone manual from the EEOC, the agency that Clarence Thomas was
mm-hmm.
chairman of,
mm-hmm.
and I just started going through the phone book, calling up the names that I found at the EEOC some years before.
And what do you say? Hi, I'm Tim Phelps. I'm a reporter. What can you tell me about? Are people forthcoming when you ask?
Oh, some people hang up the phone.
Oh, they do, yeah.
Others say, gee, I think that's an interesting subject. I'd love to talk to you about
okay.
it.
Okay. So. And at one point, do you come across the name of Anita Hill, or is that the number in the phone book?
Anita Hill's number is in the phone book in Norman, Oklahoma, yes. But I didn't call her right away. I knew that she was not anxious to go public with her story, and
mm-hmm.
I kind of didn't want to scare her. So I stayed in touch with other people who were in touch with her. But at that point, she wasn't talking to anybody. And it wasn't until several months later in September when I found out that she had told her story to the FBI
mm-hmm.
that I actually began to get the details of what allegedly had happened.
And how was that forthcoming to you? By calling the FBI, or did you get a copy of their report, or were you in contact with some members or staff to the Judiciary
Well, of course, I can't talk about exactly
I understand.
How I got the information, but...
Well, I mean, you can, but you're not going to. I mean, there's a very fine line there.
Well, the Senate tried for 4 months to get me
I know,
to do it.
I know.
They weren't successful.
I understand that. Anyway, let me just go into the speculation here. Once this story came out, there was all kinds of speculation as to who on the Judiciary Committee leaked it to the FBI. And it seemed that the ray of suspicion, the spotlight of suspicion, focused most strongly on the camps of Howard Metzenberg of Ohio and Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts. True?
Metzenbaum and Kennedy, yes.
Yeah, okay. I mean, do you know anything about that? Not that it's important to this particular case, but has it ever been nailed down as to where these charges came, or who first brought Anita Hill out, so to speak, and got her to the FBI? Do we know who that is?
Well, yes. We go into this in some length in the book. The name of Anita Hill was provided to the staffs of both Metzenbaum and Kennedy early on in August, some 3 months before the stuff became public. But at that point, they didn't even touch it. It was another month before the staffs of both senators called her. And then when she did agree to them to testify, they handed her over to Chairman Joe Biden.
Mm-hmm.
And then nothing happened again, even though she had agreed to talk.
Why not? Why the delay here of a month and more?
Well, several things. One, I don't think that the issue of sexual harassment was considered by the U.S. Senate to be any big deal at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, the senators...
As a matter of fact, it's something many of them do almost every day, I'm told, and I'm not trying to make a joke here. They call, who is the old fellow from South Carolina, Strom Thurmond, they call him Mr. Hands. There are women who will say that in elevators, every now and again, they feel a hand somewhere it shouldn't be, and there's old Strom. I mean, the guy's 86 years old, and his hand tends to wander. And they kind of put it off, well, he's old, he doesn't mean it, but this kind of stuff goes on back there.
Well, after all, one of the senators who voted on this nomination has just stepped down because of allegations of a very brutal sexual
mm-hmm.
harassment.
Mm-hmm.
This leads me to the next point, which is that so many of the senators had their own scandals, present or past, to worry about, that they were not real anxious to bring up the moral problems of a nominee.
Right, or the alleged moral turpitude of Clarence Thomas in this case.
That's right, that's right. It kind of... we found that the Senate was kind of disabled from examining questions of this kind by its own individual scandal.
But eventually, it did go public.
Yes, it never would have if reporters hadn't gotten hold of the information. Though it was basically deep sixed. Finally,
you, Nina Totenberg, and others.
No, just the two of us.
The two of you.
That's right. There were only two reporters who got the story. And
isn't it curious, and I don't mean to interrupt you here, that this story would surface through the efforts of a Supreme Court beat reporter for New York Newsday, a newspaper, and Nina Totenberg, who I believe works for National Public Radio.
Yes.
That the New York Times didn't have this, and NBC News didn't have this, and CNN didn't have this. It just interests me how often print and public broadcast beats the media upon which or from which more people get their sources than any other. You know what I'm saying here?
Well,
I mean, the great investigative report on why American democracy is on the dumper comes from two fellows who won the Pulitzer Prize on the Philadelphia Inquirer. You know, beat reporters, investigative reporters for print journalism.
Well, there's some advantage, really, in being an outsider, I think.
Yeah.
I'm a newcomer to Washington. This was my first big story in Washington. I'm a foreign correspondent by experience. And so I think coming in with a fresh eye, a fresh approach, and the skills of a beat reporter, I think provides a big advantage. You get kind of used to things when you've been in Washington too long.
And also, you have a certain anonymity. Your face is not on the tube every night. You know what I'm saying? You know, Peter Jennings and Brokaw and Rather are larger than life, and
right.
they can't operate
right.
with any kind
right.
of anonymity.
Right.
Anyway, what about all these allegations made by Anita Hill about Clarence Thomas? Pornographic movies, pubic hair on Coca-Cola cans, size of my genital organs. I mean, I sat watching these hearings along with the rest of America. I said, can this man who's a nominee for the Supreme Court, considering his background and education, have these kind of interests? As it turns out, your research has revealed that Clarence Thomas indeed had an interest in pornographic material, did he not?
Yes, and this is a little embarrassing to go into because normally I would say that reporters have no business going into the private interests of public figures.
No, they don't, except that in this particular case,
that's
friend,
right.
he may well make a ruling affecting your right and my right
well,
to
not,
engage
not
in...
just that, but our feeling was that if indeed he had an unusual interest in pornographic films, as we discovered, that this partially corroborates what Anita Hill had to say. She, after all, was saying that he liked to talk to her about pornographic films. Mm-hmm. And indeed, he had spent a lot of time watching pornographic movies and telling his friends about it.
A lot of time.
Yes, more than most people.
I mean, and did this interest develop when he was a college student? Was it something he picked up in his youth? And
we talked to classmates of Judge Thomas's at Yale Law School, who said that every Friday he went down to the local porn theater, the seamy one, you know, 4X, down the street, and watched one of these films and came back and told everybody about it.
That in itself really doesn't mean anything, but then when you attach it to the allegations made him by Professor Hill, it does mean something. What about Anita Hill? What did you turn up on Anita Hill? Is she clean as a hound's tooth in all of this? And before you answer, let me do the commercial here and get it out of the way. We're talking with Timothy Phelps tonight, who covers the Supreme Court for Newsday. He's the co-author of Capital Games, the first book now on the hearings of Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill, the confrontation that took place in an extraordinary addition to the confirmation hearings on Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. We'll be right back with Mr. Phelps and eventually some of you on the toll-free exchange after these messages from the local stations. We are back with Tim Phelps, the co-author of Capital Games, The Story of Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. What about research and investigation into Anita Hill? That must have also been a parallel part of this book if you're looking at Clarence Thomas.
Yes, it certainly was. We spent some time talking to her classmates from Yale Law School, and to her friends, colleagues, and students in Oklahoma, we learned one interesting thing about her that the public didn't find out during the hearings, which is that she's not a Republican, she's not a conservative as she was portrayed at the time. She's a kind of mainstream liberal Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
So some people may feel that they were misled about that, not by her, incidentally. But otherwise, we found that most of the people who know her describe her as perhaps the most honest person they'd ever met. We found no evidence of psychological problems of fantasizing, as the Republicans said during the hearings. And in fact, she's a leader of her community of unusual standing.
What about her loyalty to Clarence Thomas when he left, what was it, EEOC?
He left the Department of Education.
To go to EEOC, and she went with him. And the question came up at the time, if all this harassment was going on, why wouldn't she be delighted to see him leave and go on to another station and get that part of her job out of her life? Did you get anything on that at all?
Well, I mean, I don't want to act as her spokesman here.
I understand
but,
that.
We talked to a lot of experts on sexual harassment, and we were told that we're applying kind of a double standard, us men here. I mean, all of us have worked for people who we didn't like for one reason or another, who were mean to us or unfair
right.
or stupid. And we put up with it because we wanted to get ahead in our jobs,
or we
needed the money.
Right.
Anita Hill liked the work that she was doing, and was a career woman. And I think that perhaps career women are treated somehow differently still in our minds than career men. And so she did what was best for, not for her, but for her career.
For her career. In other words, he was moving up the ladder, so to speak,
right.
and she could go with him. Right.
She went with him. Now, she says that that the harassment had stopped some months before this move took place, and so she thought it was over and done with. And with that in mind, went on. But I think it's legitimate to say that this is enough to give one pause about her story, but those experts who we talked to said it's really not unusual.
After watching that whole thing that weekend last year, I am convinced that something happened between these two people. I don't know what it was. And I think that in his mind, he thinks he is giving an accurate portrayal of the events between them. And I think in her mind, she's giving an accurate portrayal of what went on between them. And whatever it was, we'll never know. But at the time, I said here, and, you know, you talk with people in your life about this situation because it involved all of us for that weekend, you say, how could these two people not be together? I mean, they were both well-educated African-Americans. They both enjoyed their work in the service of the government. They both had, from all appearances at the time, similar beliefs, similar ideas, similar goals, even though he is conservative and she is not. I just wonder what you and your co-author found out in terms of that relationship. Was there a relationship between them?
Not that I know, no. I don't subscribe to the theory, although it's held by many people, that somehow they were both telling the truth. In my view, one of two things has happened. A man now sitting on the Supreme Court has perjured himself, or an unprecedented illegal campaign to sabotage a nomination has taken place. And really, nobody in a position of authority has done anything to get to the bottom of that question.
Of course, how can we get to the bottom of it if both sides are simply trying to protect their own political backsides, the Republicans and the Democrats? Obviously, and I'm sure you have information on this, the Democrats sought to use Anita Hill to bring this nomination down, and they would stop at nothing. That was their agenda, to bring down the nomination.
Actually, I think the opposite is true. The Democrats failed to pursue this story when they had the opportunity. And 100 senators in the U.S. Senate were about to vote on this nomination. 90-some of them had never heard of Anita Hill. So the Democrats failed to pursue this. It's not that they tried to use it to bring Clarence Thomas down.
Well, I really think they did that last weekend. I really think they did. I mean, Metzenbaum, Cole, Kennedy, certainly brought Anita Hill before that committee, delayed the final confirmation vote. Their idea was to forestall this nomination.
But that wouldn't have happened if my story and Nina Totenberg's story hadn't appeared.
True. You're right. In the beginning, okay. But once it was public, once you and Ms. Totenberg had brought this story public, it was picked up by all the media. Once Anita Hill was a living, breathing, person, the Democrats, they had no choice. They had to run with it then. It's just that they waited too long to run with it. If this had been part of the hearings from day one, we probably would not have Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court today.
That's right. But they didn't run with it very effectively. And as we say in the book, I think one reason is that they were embarrassed that they hadn't taken the issue seriously before, and it made it difficult for them to pursue it thoroughly later.
Right. And as you point out in your book, there were members of the Judiciary Committee on both sides who had enough in their own closets that they don't need to go after somebody else.
Exactly.
I have to pause here. We're talking with Timothy Phelps of Capital Games. We'll be right back after station identification. Thanks for listening, everybody. Back joined tonight by Timothy Phelps, who is the Supreme Court correspondent covering the Supreme Court for Newsday, New York Newsday, the newspaper, the co-author of Capital Games, the first book written on the hearings of Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. I'll take your phone calls on this topic now at area code 800-765-0856. Well, you know, I'm dyslexic tonight. 756-0852. That's 800-756-0852. So what happens? Does this just go on? Now Clarence Thomas serves on the Supreme Court. Anita Hill lives out her life in Oklahoma. She makes a speech occasionally, possibly appears on a feminist program from time to time, continues her work at the U of O. And all this stuff at the hearing just kind of fades into memory after the television movie of Capital Games is made.
Well, it could well be what happens. I think that reporters like myself are going to continue to dog this story without...
But I mean, what's left on this story? What isn't done in this story?
What's not done is establishing who was telling the truth. And I personally am one of, I think, a minority of people who thinks that can be done.
How?
by talking to people, by going back and doing the same things I started to do in the first place.
I understand that, but how can you establish something that happened in a room occupied by only two people and it winds up he said, she said? That's tough stuff to prove, Tim.
Yeah, well, we probably can't do that, but if there are other people out there who were harassed by Clarence Thomas, I don't know what the threshold is, but if I were to find four other women who were harassed, you'd probably believe that Anita Hill was telling the truth.
Well, I believe Anita Hill was telling the truth now. If I were asked on the rack, who do you think was telling the truth, I come down on the side of Anita Hill. I didn't believe Clarence Thomas, and he lost me when he said I didn't even watch your testimony. I mean, if I were him, the first thing I'd do is watch what this woman is saying about me. I would want to know every word she said about me.
There's also other allegations that he hasn't told the truth in other formats, including in the first set of hearings when he said he'd never discussed Roe v. Wade.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if we investigate the issue of sexual harassment regarding Clarence Thomas, if we investigate whether or not anyone else was lying before the committee besides one of the two principals, if we investigate whether he told the truth about other things, I think that we can put this picture together a lot better than we have so far. It'll take a long time.
You see, there's another question to be asked here, and that is, what kind of people are presidents nominating to the Supreme Court of the United States?
Well, exactly.
People are concerned, well, the court's too liberal, the court's too conservative, and the court does swing back and forth depending upon what kind of political animal lives in the White House. But wasn't there a time when presidents sought to achieve some kind of balance on the Supreme Court? You know, Dwight Eisenhower, I mean, I'm sure he never knew that Earl Warren was going to turn out to be Earl Warren. But he certainly must have known from Warren's political record in California, where he was not that conservative a man, that some liberalism lived within him. Kennedy made some appointments of very conservative people. The present president seems to want to cast this Supreme Court in only one hue, and that's conservative.
Well, Ronald Reagan and George Bush have basically given the court to the far right. And as we say in the book, the day that Thurgood Marshall resigned, John Sununu, the chief of staff, called up Tom Jipping, a man who was the representative there of a coalition of ultra-right organizations, and said, who do you want on the court? The answer came back by fax an hour later to the White House: we want Clarence Thomas. And so what's changed is that people are not really being chosen by their qualifications. They're not being chosen because they're giants in the law. They're being chosen because they have the right ideology. And nobody questions the authority of the president, the right of the president to appoint people of their own political persuasion, but people are being chosen who don't represent even the mainstream of their views for political purposes.
So if Sununu sent the message out, who do you want, and the answer came back, we want Clarence Thomas, then the whole party line from the White House that we're going over a list of potential nominees, the president is considering a list of potential people, that was all BS.
Well, there was a bit of a disagreement within the White House over whether this was a good idea. I mean, the Attorney General, Mr. Thornburg, argued that this might not be politically wise, that he would be very controversial, and they talked a little bit about nominating an Hispanic American instead. But the conservatives in the White House, notably Boyden Gray, the counsel to the president, were adamant that it be Clarence Thomas.
We are joined now by Ann in Yakima, Washington. Hello.
Hello.
Good evening.
Yes. Well, I never believed Anita Hill for a minute, and I think she was pressured into this. And when Nina Totenberg called the senator the F word several times. But my question has always been, John Danforth has always been his mentor. He's known him since 20-some years. He would certainly have never stood up, made a passion plea before the Senate if he did not feel that this man was a good man, because Danforth, I have read, is the most respected senator and there is, and he's an Episcopal minister, maybe good or bad, but he had such an excellent reputation, and when he went and gave a passion plea, I can't imagine that he didn't fully respect Clarence Thomas and for what he stood. Can you comment on that?
Sure. There's no question that Senator Danforth is respected and was very sincere in his support for Clarence Thomas. But let me tell you two little items. One, I asked Senator Danforth during the summer after this nomination about what seemed to be a big difference between his views, Senator Danforth's views on affirmative action and Clarence Thomas's views. And he turned and he said to me, you know, I've never discussed that subject with Clarence Thomas. It's my impression that although Senator Danforth hired Clarence Thomas, that he didn't know too much about his politics and didn't really know the man as well, perhaps, as he thought he did. And one other point. When Anita Hill's charges were made public, Senator Danforth's impassioned speech on the Senate floor included the admission that he had not read the FBI report on Anita Hill's statement, nor had he read her statement to the Judiciary Committee. And so he, by his own admission, he really didn't, wasn't willing to look into it at all.
Well, everybody has certainly put down Clarence Thomas on because he had discussed something, and now so Danforth did not know his affirmative action, which is a rather neutral subject. But Anita Hill, when she came to those hearings, she looked very somber, very serious, very, abused. And yet, when she, on the following week, was having a press conference in her hometown there, or in Oklahoma, she kept the press waiting for an hour. She came in bright clothes. She came in smiling, laughing, a whole different personality. And I had the feeling that she thought she was going to be the person who was going to keep someone from the on the Supreme Court. So I've never believed her at all.
Right, except that by the time she held that press conference in Oklahoma, Clarence Thomas already had been confirmed to the Supreme Court.
I don't think so. Not the first one.
I can tell you that Anita Hill wanted no part of bringing down Clarence Thomas. I've been calling her for weeks, trying to get her to go public with this story, and she was a woman in terrible anguish because she did not want to go public with this information. She had no political agenda. I can tell you that from my own personal experience.
Well, then why is she now charging $10,000, $25,000 a pop, and that when they were going to raise money for finance a chair or whatever the phrase is for her back there, when she found out they weren't going to pay her the $10,000, she refused to come and speak like she had originally.
I don't know that that's true. I haven't heard.
No, this is stuff coming from the American Spectator magazine by my close personal friend. He really is not R. Emmett Tyrrell. I'm suspicious of any guy whose first name is an initial. In fact, if you look back in history at people who have really screwed it up, trust me on this, their first name is usually an initial, like J. Danforth Quayle. We will continue with the author of Capital Games. The co-author, Tim Phelps, is with us tonight. We will continue with more of your calls on the subject of the Clarence Thomas-Anita Hill confrontation before the entire country last year. We'll be right back after station identification. All right, we're back. Here's Peter in Orlando. Hello.
Hello there.
Hi, Peter.
Tom, I've always enjoyed listening to your show.
Thanks.
I can't say I've always agreed with your politics.
That's okay.
But it's interesting to hear what the other half is saying about the topics of the day. My two comments, I guess, are comments that lend themselves to questions.
Okay.
The first is, Mr. Phelps, are you going to go ahead and give us the big scoop? And in my mind, the big scoop is who released that FBI report, which Senate staffer, let that slip out of their hands. Because, frankly, that was not to be publicly disclosed. And in my mind, that was the greatest breach of ethics that transpired of this entire debased process. And that's a comment and a question, I guess. I don't expect an answer. But
Wait. Let's see if there's an answer. Hold on. This is the $64 question here.
Well, the answer is no.
Well, of course not. I mean, you know, you got to protect your sources and whatnot. And now we have there was a Senate investigation that was allowed to peter out. right? Without by letting the funding expire, it just kind of died on that point. It's worth pointing out, of course, that the Democrats let that happen. They don't really want to have to.
Oh, the Republicans let it happen too. It was a joint resolution that was supported by both sides that there be an investigation of 120 days. They spent close to $1 million of your money to
no subpoena power.
Oh, they did have a subpoena power. I can tell you that because I was subpoenaed.
You were able to go ahead and protect your sources. I mean, based on your status as a member of the Fourth Estate. My next question, though, however, it kind of departs from that. It relates to the whole issue of going ahead and giving the benefit of the doubt to the accused. And I know a gentleman of Mr. Snyder's ilk and your ilk, Mr. Phelps, are more than willing to give the presumption of innocence in most circumstances. Ace, I find you both kind of agreeing with each other. It's like the choir preaching to the chorus, so to speak, that the accuser is got to be right in this case. And frankly, it's a given that the accused, Mr. Thomas, is the one who's really at fault. And frankly, I think that it's only fair in this case to give the benefit of the doubt to Mr. Thomas.
Well, the presumption, in my view, was with Thomas in my head and my heart before his confrontation with Ms. Hill before the committee. After hearing her testimony, after reading the revelations contained in the book produced by my guest here tonight, Mr. Phelps, substantiating his interest in, if not his obsession with pornographic films in college, going back to his classmates, bragging
about...
What
about that? I mean, this obsession with pornographic films. I've heard that there's been conversations with unnamed individuals who said that Mr. Thomas would come home on Friday nights and discuss these films, which I find incredible when you consider the fact that he's a law student, number one,
mm-hmm.
apparently had never discussed Roe versus Wade, and I mean, which was one of the seminal cases that any law student will ever deal with,
mm-hmm.
and what is there to talk about a pornographic movie? I mean, you have...
I'll tell you what there is to talk about. I'm going to be watching very carefully because sometime during the tenure of Clarence Thomas as a Supreme Court justice, a case will come before the court involving pornographic material, pornographic motion pictures, whether or not certain books or motion pictures should be allowed to be seen by the public. And I'm going to be watching his ruling very carefully. And if this guy comes down on the side of saying that he believes that certain kinds of motion pictures may be harmful and should not be viewed by the general public, I mean, I'm going to call this guy the biggest hypocrite that ever walked.
Well, wait a minute. Let's go back to Mr. Phelps just for a brief moment.
Okay.
Well, let's go back to your original point, which I think is an interesting one.
You spoke with individuals. Is that an individual or several individuals?
There were several named individuals, actually, classmates and friends of Clarence Thomas.
Of friends, quote-unquote. And these are individuals whose names are mentioned in the book.
Yes.
And they've come out in... Well, I guess that's something worth putting in your...
Well, it's worth putting in the mix, and as I say, hey, listen, if Clarence Thomas wants to view a nudie cutie, I got no problem with that.
Yeah.
The only problem I have with it, my friend, is if all of a sudden this man is deciding what you and I and Tim can look at, and he says, no, we can't look at those things, but wait a second, Clarence, you looked at them. There's a conflict there, in my view. I could be wrong, but in my mind, there's a conflict there.
I guess it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But, I mean, when you go ahead and look at the totality of the circumstances, the passage of time, the fact that she stayed with him, even assuming some untoward comments were made, that does not make sexual harassment because the claim has to be brought within 6 months. It might shine something on his character, but you got to stack up whatever that she's saying and her credibility against his years and years and years of public service and a leader and an example to the black community. I think it's been a real shame. And I think a real possible idol, a real possible example for other blacks to follow has been tarnished.
But if you accept what you say, that maybe he did make a few comments, in your view, that's no big deal in terms of sexual harassment. But the real issue here is that if what you suggest is true, then we have a perjurer on the Supreme Court.
I have to pause here for the sponsors. We're talking with Timothy Phelps, who is the co-author with Capital Games. We will continue with Mr. Phelps, and if I have time, more of you on the toll-free exchange right after these messages. We are back chatting tonight with Timothy Phelps, who along with Helen Winternitz is the co-author of Capital Games, the first full-length book on the story behind Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill, and their confrontation. While I have you here, because you do cover the Supreme Court on a regular basis, just your take on the decisions yesterday involving allowing people in some cases to move against tobacco companies for injury caused to smokers, and the decision to uphold the prescription against prayer in public schools.
Yeah, it shows that this court can still surprise us. People say, well, it's a conservative court, and there's no nothing to surprise us at all anymore. But the court ruled 5-4, very narrow, very close call there, that that prayers at a high school or middle school graduation ceremony, even non-sectarian prayers, were not to be permitted. And the court had been expected to kind of loosen the rules about prayer in the schools. But with the help of Justice Souter, who...
Which, by the way, was a surprising vote to many people, including me.
It was. It was. Justice Souter,
I would expect him to come down for school prayer, considering what we were told about him before he took the bench.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting comparing his nomination process with that of Judge Thomas. If people say the Democrats are out to get anybody that that the president puts forward, but Justice Souter was approved almost unanimously by the Senate. He is a man with a lot of experience in the law, a lot of versatility with the law, with a personality that that everybody liked, and he sailed through the Senate. And while he's been conservative, he's proven himself to be a thinking conservative, who takes each case at the at a time.
In your view, he knows the law?
Yes.
Did we miss a great one in Bob Bork?
Well, there's no question that Judge Bork has a tremendous legal mind, and was as qualified in that sense as any nominee in recent history. I mean, the problem is that he had a very extreme ideology and a very narrow view of the Bill of Rights, and that his views were a little scary, really, and even some conservatives decided that maybe he wouldn't be such a great asset to the court, but there was no question about his qualifications for the job.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate your time tonight, Timothy. I know you've had a long day working here in Southern California. On behalf of the work done by you and Helen Winternitz, and I thank you again for joining us this evening.
Thanks very much,
My
Tom.
Pleasure. Mr. Timothy Phelps, who covers the Supreme Court of the United States for New York Newsday, the newspaper back in Manhattan and Long Island, and the author, along with Helen, of a new book called Capital Games, the story of Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. Coming up, all of you, on the Toll-Free Exchange. This is the Thursday Night Radio Show. Thanks for listening, everybody.